Hey, this is Jalen Howell of the U.S. Women's Soccer Team, and you're listening to Trained, Body and Mind.
Oh, hello. Welcome to Trained, Body and Mind, a podcast exploring the cutting edge of holistic fitness. I'm your host, Jacqueline Beyer. Each episode, I connect with the world's leading experts and athletes to talk about mindset, movement, nutrition, recovery, and sleep, what we like to call the five facets of fitness. Today, I'm talking with a psychiatrist slash neuroscientist who studies how effective mindfulness can be in unwinding unhealthy habits.
Mindfulness as a concept is already challenging because it's this ineffable experience. So I really focus on the concrete aspects. To keep it simple, what I have folks in my clinic do is I just have them ask this simple question: what am I getting from this? Not intellectually, but really feeling into their bodies.
That's Dr. Judson Brewer. He's the Director of Research and Innovation at the Mindfulness Center of Brown University. His research explores the complicated world of habits versus addictions, cravings versus control, and the motivations and triggers that can dictate our healthy and unhealthy habits. And that's exactly what we dive into in this episode. You'll also get a sense for why Dr. Judd's 2016 TED Talk, A Simple Way to Break a Bad Habit, was the fourth most watched talk that year, and now has over 18 million hits. I want to kick things off with what might be a surprising topic for the show: peanut butter cups and gummy worms. So we will both need to be a little bit vulnerable here. I can start. Let's just say my relationship with peanut butter cups is out of control, to say the least. So one always becomes two always becomes four has been known to become 14. I wish I were lying, but you know the drill, yeah?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Tell me about your relationship with gummy worms. I heard something about that.
One becomes two becomes four becomes 14. The entire bag, really? I ate the whole bag? I didn't even know my stomach could handle that. Oh, it can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So then let's unpack what's going on here. I think it'd be fun to start with what we used to know, what science used to tell us about cravings like this.
Basically, you know, the food industry is really good at engineering stuff to be addictive. You know, and some talk about the bliss point where you get this perfect ratio of sugar to salt to fat. Some talk about, you know, it's the color, it's the mouthfeel, it's the crunch, it's the everything. I think it's about engineering stuff. And I say stuff because this isn't, if you look at a gummy worm, you would probably think it's a fishing lure as compared to something that you would put in your mouth. These things are really engineered, not necessarily for our biologically evolved brain to like, but to like get us totally addicted to them.
Okay. Has it changed at all from what we thought we knew about cravings in the past to where we are today with them?
You know, it hasn't changed a whole lot. And some of that is that we haven't really nailed, you know, the neurobiologic process of craving. There are some pathways that seem pretty consistent. Basically, it's this process that gets laid down to help us learn things. And this also relates, you know, to the gummy worms and the peanut butter cups. So you can think of it as there are three elements that are required for us to learn something. Those are a trigger, a behavior, and a result. So think of our ancient ancestors who are out on the savanna or in the forest looking for food. When they find food, there's that trigger. They eat the food. There's the behavior. And then their stomach sends this dopamine signal to their brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. And then the dopamine firing gets really interesting. It shifts from like that reward, like, oh, that was good. That, you know, those berries tasted good, to anticipation. And they have this urge, this craving to go out and find that food again. But in modern day, we can learn, oh, you can actually make people eat stuff even when they're not hungry. You can make people keep eating beyond satiety, beyond fullness. And the way you could do that is get these chemicals in, you know, and get the process set up to have people want more and more and more. They're never satisfied. You know, I think it was 1963 that Lay's came out with the Bet You Can't Just Eat One, you know, for their potato chip commercial. 1963, right? They're really figuring out the process to get people to not be satisfied with one potato chip or two potato chips or one peanut butter cup or two peanut butter cups. Does that get at what you're talking about?
Yeah, it does. And so I think a question for you then would be, you know, after we eat the bag of gummy worms, the whole, you know, carton of peanut butter cups, the reward kind of goes away quickly, right? You start to feel like you ate too much. You might feel a little sick. You might feel a little bit of shame. Why then is it so easy for us to continue that behavior and that moderation is difficult when perhaps the bigger reward is in the moderation?
Yeah, isn't that a great question? So think of reward from a neuroscience perspective. These reward pathways were just named reward pathways. They could have been named memory pathways. They could have been named something else, but the name reward stuck. And so people think of dopamine firing as rewarding. But if you really look at dopamine firing, so in my clinic, in my addiction clinic, my patients who are addicted to cocaine or some other substance or even their phones, they don't talk about that craving as feeling good. There's nothing pleasant in that urge. That urge is not supposed to be pleasant. So you bring up this good question, like if that reward goes away, if we look at it, there never really was, you know, a reward. But we can separate that wanting from what people describe as liking, you know, this really important distinction between something that is pleasant versus something that is wanted or we feel like we have to have. Those are very different things and serve different functions. So for example, you could eat a peanut butter cup and it could taste good. It could be pleasant. It could have a pleasant mouthfeel. And or you could eat one and then your brain says, give me another. I want more. I want more. Those are separable, right? So we could eat a peanut butter cup and be satisfied. But there's something about, you know, this bliss point, especially I think with refined sugar. And the research is ongoing, but I think there's probably enough research to say this. With sugar, there's something that drives us to get more. So our survival brains say, you know, get as much sugar as you can in your body so you can store it as fat. So in case there is a famine, you can survive. In modern day, fortunately for most of us, we have ready access to food. And thanks to all sorts of things that make sugar cheap, basically, you know, corn syrup subsidies and things like that, all of those things make it more profitable for people to sell things that are sugar-laden, especially because the sugar-laden stuff sells more because people will eat more.
That makes perfect sense. So, you know, I think we're going to talk a lot today about being hooked on things or behaviors that maybe we wish we weren't. And I think just to make this relatable, whether we're talking about exercise or stress eating or any other behavior that isn't really serving us, would you say that regardless of what we're addicted to, regardless of what our habits are, essentially our brains are all wired to work the same way so we can kind of relate to each other and just fill in the blank of what it is that we're struggling with in the moment?
Absolutely. Yeah, this basic process, it's amazing how far it extends. It extends from everything from addiction to anxiety even. You know, anxiety can be driven the same way.
So let's talk about that then, because I think the words do matter there. So how do you feel about labeling habits or behaviors as bad? And then do you know anything about how the choices of those words help or hurt people on these journeys to change their behaviors?
So I'm glad you bring this up because this is really important. When we label something as good or bad, I have a good habit, I have a bad habit, there's that judgment. And when we judge ourselves, whether it's good or bad, that sets up habits of expectation and judgment on top of the habit itself. And then that can actually trigger me to feel bad. And then when I feel bad, I eat gummy worms to feel good. And then it just drives the habit mm-hmm. onto itself. It doesn't help it at all. Whereas if we label these differently, if we just say helpful, unhelpful, I think that distinction, that terminology is more helpful mm-hmm. than good and bad, because we can say to ourselves, well, is this helping me thrive? Is this helping me live a good life? Is this helping me feel healthy as compared to, is this not helping me? Is this getting in the way? And when we look at that, then it actually frame shifts it so that we can really explore, oh, this is about being kind, being healthy, being helpful to myself or to others. And when we do that, it helps us orient toward what the goal is as compared to taking all that energy where we beat ourselves up or congratulate ourselves. The congratulations is also a waste of energy.
And can we get really, really clear on the spectrum of behaviors here? Like what is a craving versus a habit versus an addiction, things like that? Because I think we'll use these terms a lot today and maybe they're interchangeable, maybe they're not.
I think of the spectrum from habit to addiction. Habits, whether there's a craving or not that's conscious or not conscious, we just do things automatically. I think of it as set and forget. And that's important because we have to form habits so that we can free up brain space to learn new things. So all of that is set up to help us be efficient so that we can learn new things every day. So that's what habits are all about. Now, if you go down that spectrum from habit to addiction, the simple definition of addiction that I learned when I was in residency is continued use despite adverse consequences. I really like that for a number of reasons. One, it's simple. And two, it's not just about the classic, you know, cocaine or heroin or fentanyl or whatever. It's about anything. We can get addicted to anything. And I've even had patients in my clinic who have shifted addiction from, say, cocaine to exercise, where they're just replacing one with another, but they're still addicted. That continued use despite adverse consequences covers the entire range of things. And I think it's really helpful in that way.
Yeah, for sure. And then is a habit the same as a habit loop, or is there a difference there?
They're the same. So a habit loop, you can just think of, you know, we talk about those three elements. Think of drawing arrows from the trigger to the behavior and an arrow from the behavior to the result, and then an arrow from the result back to the trigger. And that's what that habit loop is all about. But that's how almost all habits are formed.
So would you say then, is it harder to unwind a habit than it is to break an addiction? Or are they both difficult in their own ways?
I think they're both difficult in their own ways, and they share features that are difficult as well. So for example, with addictions, they're difficult, well, especially if there's a substance that's involved. We can have this physiologic dependence. If we're addicted to cigarettes, for example, we can get withdrawal when we stop smoking, and that feels uncomfortable. And things that are uncomfortable fall into this habit loop thing. So negative reinforcement setups, where if there's something unpleasant, there's the trigger. We do the behavior to make that unpleasant thing go away. There's the behavior. And then from a neuroscientific standpoint, that reward is that we feel less bad. We feel a little bit better. And then that feeds back and says, oh, do that again. So there can be physiologic dependence, but that's not all of it. You know, there's a ton of psychological dependence on a substance or a behavior itself. You know, I see a lot of my patients who quit smoking. The hardest part of the quitting is not necessarily getting down to, you know, just a few cigarettes where they're not physiologically dependent anymore. The hardest part is that psychological dependence where their brain is just screaming at them saying, but you've done this forever. You know, you've got to keep doing it. So that brings out another element here, which is that our brains don't like change. So smoking, for example, is an addiction in particular that we can set it up so that it gets really, really, really ingrained. And all the studies that my lab has done, I think 90 or 95% of smokers have started smoking by the age of 18 or 19. So I had a patient who'd been smoking about 40 years, and we actually calculated the number of times he had reinforced that habit loop. Ready for this? Roughly 293,000.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, 293,000.
So then what role do shame and or willpower play in all of this?
I'd be curious because shame can go two different ways. So which way are you thinking of shame? And let's start there.
I think there's the internal shame, you know, that you might feel from knowing that you should not be doing something, feeling like you don't need to do something, but doing it anyway, and then ending up in the same place over and over again. And then also maybe the shame that you are assuming that you're feeling from other people in culture for doing a behavior that they might be judging you for.
Yes. Let's start with that external judgment. Let's use smoking as an example. We know smoking's bad for us. Nobody thinks smoking is good for them. Often people come to me, they want to quit smoking because they're about to have their first child, or but their spouse is threatening to leave them because, you know, because they just can't handle their smoking anymore. And so there can be this external pressure that for some people can help them kind of feel the pain, so to speak, of, you know, of the negative consequences of smoking. And the same can be true for any addiction. And that for some people, that can be helpful. For some people, it can actually just make them feel more internally ashamed. And so we feel like there's something wrong with us. And that shame can be a shame spiral. And then people feel like they don't have self-efficacy or can't change themselves. And then they feel even more ashamed. So from a neuroscientific standpoint, willpower does not factor into habit change or addiction at all, like full stop. it is really a heuristic that helps us feel like we have some agency in this process. What is true is that whole reward process that we've been talking about, which basically says you're not going to change a behavior unless you change how rewarding it is, right? This process that we've talked about, these habit loops, scientific term for that is reward-based learning. And that means if something is rewarding, we're going to do it again. It doesn't even matter what the behavior is. We have this app called Eat Right Now where we embedded a tool where we had people pay attention as they overate. And this program is set up to help people map out these habit loops around eating and work with them, not using willpower. It's not based on willpower. And what we find is within 10 to 15 times of somebody really paying attention as they overeat, that reward value goes below zero. It only takes 10 to 15 times. It doesn't matter how many years they've been overeating. Wow. Yeah. And we can adapt to our eating environment pretty quickly. But the one thing that we have to do is pay attention, right? That has nothing to do with willpower. And as we pay attention, we start to realize that, you know, it doesn't feel good when we overeat. So let me ask you this. How does it feel when you eat that entire sleeve or that entire bag of peanut butter cups? Does it feel good?
No, it feels terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Do you encourage people to, I mean, I guess within the app you probably do, but like to track a way to see how you're progressing toward that number. And then maybe that becomes a motivation too. Like the more times I log awareness of this, the more I'm motivated to continue to log awareness, that then itself becomes a habit in a way.
Yeah, it becomes self-reinforcing because it feels good when we don't overeat, for example. It feels good when we pay attention and we notice, oh, you know, one peanut butter cup tastes good, two tastes good, three, you know, I'm starting to not taste so good. And we can actually stop. I call it the pleasure plateau. We can stop when that pleasure plateaus off and then it is just driven by craving. And if we don't pay attention, we go off that cliff of overindulgence and then we end up feeling crappy. And it kind of supersedes all of the pleasure that could have come from just simply eating one.
When we come back from the break, Dr. Judd talks about the challenges of studying mindfulness, the future of app-based therapeutics, and I, well, how do I say this? I offer myself up as a study subject. So I want to dig a little bit more into the awareness, the mindfulness side of things, because that seems to be something that you've spent a lot of time researching and finding evidence for being a really powerful tactic in this space. So I think for mindfulness specifically, I would love for you to share the operational definition of mindfulness with us.
There are many definitions of mindfulness. So I think the most commonly used one was put forward by Jon Kabat-Zinn back in the late 70s, where he talks about paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. Now, that can sound like a mouthful. So I like to think of it pragmatically as having two key elements. One is awareness, right? We've been talking about awareness. But the other is this attitude, this attitudinal quality of being curious, you know, and that's kind of a positive framing of non-judgment. And so if we just get curious and we pay attention, oh, what's it feel like? Instead of going, oh no, I've got to force myself not to overeat. Oh, what's it feel like when I eat one peanut butter cup? Oh, what's it feel like when I eat two? Oh, and then it really helps us kind of find that, if there is one, find that sweet spot where it's like, oh, it's two of this, it's one of this.
And so is it difficult to get objective data on something that is as subjective as mindfulness and curiosity? Like, how do you study them?
There are a number of ways to study them, and all of these have problems. So none of them is the perfect way to do it. So my lab uses a bunch of different types of techniques. So we'll use self-report, where we can have measures where people pay attention and see how often they are paying attention, and there are different questionnaires for that. We can also do things that are called experience sampling or ecological momentary assessment, where we can ping people in the middle of their days and ask them, hey, were you just paying attention and what was that like? And we can even embed that into our apps, like our anxiety app or our eating app. When we're doing studies, we can actually ask people in their environments what's going on. And then there are other ways to measure these things, try to measure them, or at least measure the neural correlates when using things like EEG and fMRI. And we're just measuring their brain activity as they were meditating compared to people who had just learned to meditate that morning.
You mentioned some of the limitations of studying mindfulness. What are those common limitations?
The common limitations are we're talking about this ineffable experience, something that is, as soon as you put words on it, you've tainted the experience itself. You know, like we're trying to measure these fundamental aspects of human experience, like consciousness, you know, and conscious awareness and curiosity. And let's just say questionnaires only go so far. And even neuroimaging studies only go so far. They only look at, you know, what's lighting up in the brain when somebody is doing something. It doesn't mean that that brain region or even that brain network is the essential causal component there. So there is no brain region that is the mindfulness brain region.
Interesting. So then what evidence do you have so far that shows that mindfulness is a really strong tool for unwinding habits that you don't want to have anymore?
Well, my lab's been engaged in studies for decades now. We've specifically looked at addictions and habits. So for example, we did a study with people who wanted to quit smoking. And we, you know, randomized them to get gold standard treatment, which is cognitive therapy. And another group was randomized to get mindfulness training. And we found, ready for this, that mindfulness training was 5 times better than the gold standard treatment at helping people quit and stay quit.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, it was just our first study that a lot more work needs to be done. Yet it indicated to us that this is possible. Because I was, you know, a little skeptical that paying attention could actually help people change habits. And I hadn't really gotten into the reward-based learning piece yet. But then it made complete sense later when we started bringing those elements in. And then we did a study, we developed this Eat Right Now app, and we did a study led by Ashley Mason at UCSF finding that mindful awareness could help people reduce craving-related eating by 40%. So that was, you know, it's not 5% or 4%, it's 40%. But really the hallmark of science is replication. So when we developed this unwinding anxiety app, and this was one of the most amazing things that I ever learned, was that anxiety can actually be driven like a habit. You know, I never learned that in residency. So when we developed that program and wanted to see, can we actually target, you know, reward-based learning to help people become less anxious, we did a study with anxious physicians. We got 57% reduction in anxiety. We did a randomized controlled trial in people with generalized anxiety disorder. We got a 67% reduction in anxiety. We did another study where we got a similar magnitude. And again, it's relatively early on, but it's pretty promising what we're finding.
So what might that look like then? If I were to come to you and say, I have X habit or X addiction and I want to tap into mindfulness to try to change that.
Okay, so if you came into my clinic, the first thing I would do is I'd take history and have you just start talking about why you came to see me. So often I'll say, you know, how can I be of help? And I'll just, as people describe what their experience is and what they're struggling with, my mind will be making notes around, okay, what habit loops am I hearing here? And so for you, let's say you came and said, I'm struggling, I'm exercising too much. So I might even ask some paradoxical questions like, well, why not exercise more? You know, what's wrong with that? So if I asked you that question, like, why not exercise more? What would you say?
Because I have a day job and a kid and other things that I need to devote the hours in my day to.
So what we would do then after I got some information, and I literally do this with my patient, I'd pull out a blank piece of paper and I'd write down trigger behavior result. And I say, okay, let's see if we can map some of this stuff out. And I usually start with the behavior itself, because that's pretty concrete. So what would you say the behavior is? How would you describe that? Is it over-exercising or what? Because exercise itself isn't a problem.
Yeah, like I'll get through 2 weeks and I'll be like, oh, my hips feeling a little tight or something. And then I'm like, when was the last time I took a rest day? And then I cannot remember.
So we would map that out together. We might start with the exercise, like where the behavior is not taking a rest day or not caring for your body in the best way that it can be. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And then you've already mapped out some of those results, which is, oh, you know, my hips are feeling a little tighter. My body's not optimal. My body is telling me that there are some negative results here. And then we might map it back to the trigger that might say, oh, I might do a rest day or do some yoga, but then it's like, oh, but I want to exercise, okay? So then I would just write down, the trigger might be a thought, which is like, oh, I'd rather exercise. The behavior is to go ahead and exercise on a day when you might be better off taking a break. And then the result is, let's say, and hopefully this doesn't happen to you or to other people, but you might get injured, right? Or there's an overuse injury or something like that, God forbid. That's mm-hmm. where the real negative consequences come in. And so those negative consequences, we map that out and then draw these arrows between the three and say, okay, this is how habit loops are formed. The second step would be to really dive into that neurobiology that we've been talking about, which is about the reward, how rewarding is something. So then I would ask you to really think carefully about like, well, what are all the things that you get? What are the results? Let's just objectively name them. So you talked about how exercise can feel good, right? You also talked about how when you exercise too much, your body might not feel as good. What else would you fill in there if we were to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes me feel strong, pushing your body really hard. I feel mentally strong and physically strong. I think sometimes, you know, I can tell if I'm a little tired in the morning. I get up at the same time every day, but that's another sign maybe that I've been overdoing it too. If I want to press snooze and stay in bed, just energy for my day. I'm a happier person. I think I'm sharper at the office. Do you need me to provide any more?
No, that's good. You're describing something. This is just like eating, you know, eating healthy food versus overeating, for example. Eating healthy food, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it's called healthy food for a reason. Exercising is good for us until it's not, where, you know, where we hit that threshold where we've overexercised. So let's use a hypothetical, because unfortunately, I don't think you've hit this. But let's say you came in and you said, I've got this sports injury. I know it's an overuse injury. I just can't stop doing it. So this brings in this aspect around how rewarding something is.
Well, Dr. Judd, let me interrupt you and say that I do have bicep tendonitis right now, and it is an overuse. Okay. So it's not one that's like, I can work around it, but it mm-hmm. is something that is because I've been overusing it. So yeah. I can't, you know, I couldn't let you go on thinking that.
Okay. So, well, we can even use that as an example. So this might sound like an obvious, you know, state the obvious, but what feels better when your biceps are in optimal shape or when you've got that overuse tendonitis? Which one feels better?
When they're in optimal shape.
Yeah. Yeah. So that to our brain is saying, well, you know what the answer is, right? And we can know this intellectually, like, oh, if mm-hmm. I just find that optimal zone, then I can stay there. So we can be thinking, oh, I should really take care of my biceps. But then our body's like, oh, I got to lift because I haven't used them enough, right? I'm going to lose my fitness. And so that urge supersedes and kind of wins out over what we know is good for us until we pay careful attention and we ask ourselves, what am I getting from this? So let's say that you keep working out with your biceps, however you're doing that to overuse them, and you're seeing the negative consequences. As you pay more and more careful attention to the negative consequences, does that make you want to work out more or does it make you want to take care of them?
Take care of them.
Yeah. So the answer, like you were saying earlier, it's simple, but it's not easy. But the mm-hmm. answer is simple. And the answer is if we listen to our bodies know best, right?
I was just going to say, so, I mean, we all have a natural awareness. I'm sure we might all benefit from having a proper training in mindfulness and tapping into that awareness. Like, how do you coach somebody for the first time who's maybe never tried it before to begin doing it?
Yeah, and I don't even use the term mindfulness that much anymore because it's a concept. And mm-hmm. you know, if it's a concept, somebody has to learn it and they might learn it properly, they might not. And, you know, mindfulness as a concept is already challenging because it's this ineffable experience. So I really focus on the concrete aspects. And I talk about awareness and in particular focus in on curiosity. So here, to keep it simple, what I have folks in my clinic do is I just have them ask this simple question, what am I getting from this? But not intellectually, but really feeling into their body. So for example, if you find yourself working your bicep out, even though it's painful, and you ask yourself, what am I getting from this? What would your answer be?
I mean, if I were being honest with myself, it would be nothing. But if I were trying to talk myself into giving myself permission to keep going, I would say, oh, but I'm working other parts of my body and it'll heal over time. And it's not feeling worse, but it's not feeling great.
Right, right. So being honest with ourselves, that's what awareness is all about. And so that's where I would walk somebody through this. I'd say, well, pay attention, be curious, allow whatever answer to come up to be there because that's the answer and see how much you can be honest with yourself. And here, you know, we all have this capacity to be curious. It's about the journey. And life, as cliche as it is, life really is that journey. So in the journey, we can be asking ourselves, oh, what am I getting from this? What do I get from overworking my biceps? And like you're saying, nothing. So as we start to see very clearly and not try to convince ourselves that we should take care of ourselves, the shoulds, you know, we should all over ourselves. That just doesn't work. It's not about what we should do. It's about listening to the wisdom of our bodies. And when we listen to the wisdom of our body says, hey, you're not getting anything from this. And so we become disenchanted with that behavior. So that disenchantment helps us change behavior. But there's another element. I think of this as the third step. That third step is what helps us really solidify these things. So our brains, they're always looking for something better. I call it the BBO, the bigger, better offer. So our brains say, well, when I overuse my muscles, it doesn't feel good. I don't get anything from this. So that's what it's all about, is finding that bigger, better offer. And the bigger, better offer can simply be rest. So when you rest enough to let your biceps fully heal and have that tendonitis heal, and then you can go back and start using them optimally, how does that feel?
That feels great.
Yeah, better, hey?
Yeah.
So there's the bigger, better offer.
Well, how much does instant gratification get in the way of that? Because a lot of the bigger, better offers, at least maybe in these examples, feel a little bit more longer term to appreciate and realize versus the instant gratification of doing something that you think you want in the moment.
Yeah, it's a great question. And our brains are set up, there's this whole process called delayed discounting, where we discount future rewards for immediate rewards, even if the immediate reward is smaller. So with exercise, the immediate reward could be, I got my workout in today. And that can lead to a long-term negative effect of tendonitis or not functioning at optimal. But it's hard for our brains to think a week ahead. So here, that instant gratification can get in the way and cloud our judgment. And the key here is we've got to see where we're stuck. And typically, we're stuck in our heads. And we can learn from those things.
And you wrote about two acronyms in your books that I personally found to be super powerful. The first one was HALT and the second one is RAIN. Can you talk us through what each of those mean and how we might be able to use them to, again, promote the behaviors that we want to be doing throughout the day?
Sure. HALT, I learned HALT back in residency, which it stands for Hungry, Angry, Lonely, Tired. And the HALT acronym is there, especially for people who struggle with addictions, to say, hey, these are times when you're vulnerable, when you're hungry, when you're angry, when you're lonely, when you're tired. So the HALT acronym is really helpful to just keep in mind so that we can be on the lookout for things that are indicating that we're not functioning optimally. And then we can take care of ourselves in those ways.
Got it. And then where does RAIN come into the picture?
So RAIN's this acronym that was developed by Michelle McDonald, a meditation teacher, and then popularized by Tara Brach. And it stands for, the R stands for recognize. So if we're about to do a behavior that might not be helpful or healthy for us, if we don't recognize it and it's habitual, we're just going to do it. So we've got to recognize what we're about to do. And then the A stands for allow or accept, or at least acknowledge, you know, acknowledge what's about to happen. And it's important to allow ourselves to feel the cravings, especially because if we don't, if we try to resist them or we try to avoid them, we're kind of trying to sidestep a problem, or the resistance itself can make them even stronger. So, you know, that idea of what we resist persists is true. The I stands for investigate. And what that stands for is truly being curious about our experience. So we can investigate what's actually happening. And then the N, people use different terms for N. It was originally described as non-identification, which can seem like a brain full. So we use a different practice called noting. You know, just note whatever's happening in your experience. Note whatever your five senses are. And so that's what noting, that N for noting, is all about. If we can note our experience, we can ride that wave of craving. And we can see, if I don't get caught up in that urge to do whatever the behavior is, to smoke, to eat, to exercise. And so RAIN can help people recognize when an urge to do something's coming on, allow that craving to be there instead of fighting it, get curious, oh, what does this feel like in my body? And then really note from moment to moment what that craving feels like as it comes and goes.
And how long do you recommend people sit with that, with the idea of RAIN? Is it something that you can do quickly, like you said, in 30 seconds? Is it something that maybe takes a few minutes? When is it most effective?
I would say it can be effective anytime somebody has a craving. Where I find people tripping themselves up is when they're kind of forcing the noting and they're not really truly being curious and allowing whatever the experience is to be there. Or they have some expectation that if I do RAIN, then my craving will go away and it better be gone in 30 seconds or this doesn't work. So this is really about changing our relationship to our experience and truly allowing whatever's going to happen.
I'm curious where this area of research is heading now. Like, what do you find the most exciting about what you're working on and where you think this field is going?
You know, I feel like we're just scratching the surface where we're really able to dial in and start leveraging the power of our brains to really change our behaviors. And I'm excited to see just how many different types of habitual behaviors we can apply this to. There are some good studies showing that mindfulness training can help people with depression, for example. Those thought loops that we get caught up in when we're anxious, when we're worried, the same type of thought loops and even the same brain regions are activated when people get caught up in regretting the past. So whether it's regretting the past or worrying about the future, we're still caught up in a habit loop. So I'm excited to see how we can take this forward with depression. There's some good work in person with mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, for example, showing that it can be helpful, even to the point where it's been adopted in the UK as part of their national health system. So here, that's one exciting piece. And the other is the field of digital therapeutics, developing programs and delivering them through app-based platforms, I think is really exciting because this can make this more accessible to anybody with a smartphone, which is most people these days. Yeah. The problem is that a lot of the early folks were like, oh, I want to develop a digital therapeutic, were mostly developed by industry and by programmers, not in conjunction with therapists or researchers. So a lot of these folks have to beware. There are tons of apps out there. Very, very, very few. It's like less than 1% have any evidence or research behind them. So not all apps are created equal, but I'm really excited to see the field mature as more studies are done. And then another thing I'm really excited about is to see how we can personalize these trainings, where we can get people's tendencies and see who's going to benefit best from what. And then also how we can tweak things this way or that way to optimize and personalize training for each person. So really excited to do that work as well.
Well, Dr. Judd, this is super fascinating. You're doing awesome work, making a lot of great changes in the world, helping a lot of people. So I'm grateful that we had the opportunity to have this chat with you today. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I want to say this first and foremost. Addiction is an incredibly serious topic, and its impact on individuals and society can be devastating. But I hope you picked up on the fact that Dr. Judd and I really wanted to focus on the other end of the spectrum, the unhealthy loops we can all get caught up in. And I find it fascinating that mindfulness, something so conceptual, so prone to misunderstanding, and so often cliche, is actually being studied by someone, and that its therapeutic potential may be greater than we ever imagined. Finally, I find myself thinking about that acronym RAIN in all sorts of situations. If you catch yourself getting wound up in a loop or on the edge of getting stressed out, stop and let it rain. Recognize, acknowledge, investigate with true curiosity, and note, or just try to be witness to it. On our next episode of Trained, we step on the gridiron and chat with one of the strongest, toughest, most punishing, and nicest players in the NFL, Derrick Henry of the Tennessee Titans. This has been Trained. Talk to you soon. If you've enjoyed this episode of Trained, help us spread the word by rating and reviewing the podcast. That way we can keep making great episodes for you to listen to. And it helps other people find us too. If you've got a question for me or my guests or a topic you'd like to see covered, email me at trained@nike.com and I'll see what I can do.
Thanks for listening to Trained. Just a reminder, always talk with your doctor before starting any training or nutrition program. The information we provide isn't a substitute for any medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and the individual opinions expressed here are just that, opinions.